In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Past guest Harry Hubbard explained how when researching for The Real Thanksgiving, he found it had taken centuries to actually publish manuscripts describing events at the Plymouth Colony and Massachusetts Bay Colony in the 1600s. For example, on the retreat of the British Army in 1775, manuscripts written in 1602 were taken from the Old South Church in Boston and later recovered and printed by the Massachusetts Historical Society in 1856, 200 years later. This gives you an idea of the potential to distort accurate historic documentation or how important information was conveniently omitted. Information such as the enslavement of poor white people. However, if you research with a focus on white slavery, you'll find documentation scattered among the manuscripts in private libraries. Our guest, Michael Hoffman, wrote the book They Were White and They Were Slaves, The Untold Story of Enslavement of Whites in Early America, which brings together the many historic references chronicling nearly 4,000 years of white enslavement, from Greek and Roman slavery to the Visigoths and Russian Muscovites, to the Vikings selling the Irish to the Muslims in Spain, to the factory horrors of industrialized Great Britain in the 1600s. Hoffman's research continues through to Caucasian Americans arriving at the New World and the West Indies in bondage, enslaved into agrarian labor. We talk about the timeline of white enslavement, why this historic documentation continues to be undermined and suppressed to this day, and how some consider this book to be an indictment to establishment media, historians, and academics who ignore or downplay the history of white enslavement. Our guest, author and scholar Michael Hoffman, is a revisionist historian. He joins us to talk more about the book and his research. He's the author of many books, but in this interview we focus on They Were White and They Were Slaves. Michael Hoffman, welcome to Another News.
Thank you, Jeff. It's good to be here.
Can you please give listeners an overview of the timelines in this book and how many whites were estimated to have become slaves?
Well, the timeline in my book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, The Untold History of the Enslavement of Whites in Early America, I run from the Middle Ages up until the present in terms of, not that I'm suggesting that whites are slaves in any massive sense now, but in terms of dealing with things like white skin privilege and other associated matters. But for the core of the history, it pretty much concludes with the time of the war between the states, the American Civil War. And the reason why I go back into the Middle Ages is to explain the very roots of the word slave and also slavery worldwide. The notion that slavery is limited entirely to sub-Saharan black Africans is so absurd when we look at the whole survey of world history, and that was necessary to conduct in the book. As far as the numbers go, that's very ambiguous, and I could give you better figures, for example, for the white slaves who were so-called impressed aboard British warships from the 17th century into the 18th, and that number generally agreed upon as approximately a 250,000 of those people who were enslaved. My own estimate would be in the high hundreds of thousands or low millions into America, but I wouldn't want to have to say that I have strict numbers on that, because what we're dealing with here, Jeff, is a shameful, humiliating ordeal for whites who were not in any way proud or who even cared to note the background of their enslavement because of the hereditary taint that had been associated with the enslavement of whites all the way back into the Viking thralls. Thraldom was the term for slavery in Scandinavia, and that was associated with a hereditary taint. So what you see is that among whites, there's a tendency to deny it. But, and also among historians, of course, and we'll get into that later. So when you have this massive area of denial, it's difficult to come up with statistics. But I have found the sweep of many historians who will tacitly acknowledge some aspects of my thesis by suggesting, for example, Brunsman in his book, which is Denver Brunsman has written a book on the impressment of sailors, but he took a detour to discuss unfree labor, and that's a fair enough term for the experience of both blacks and whites and American Indians, Native Americans as well, in North America. And he gave a figure of 3/4 of all whites immigrating to America were experiencing some form of unfree labor experience. Now, of course, my opponent in this debate will say that that was almost exclusively indentured servitude, which I find risible.
Yes, I want to get into your opponent's challenges on that indentured servitude. This book was written, was published back in 1992, and I wanted to ask you, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, it is published in 1992, and I've been working on a sequel for quite a while now, but other projects have interfered. The sequel is to be titled Hanging Poor Whites and is centered on the Tyburn Gallows in Great Britain and the type of very low status that English people, Scottish people, the working class, particularly in the 18th century, had there. But my motives were is that as I was researching the war between the states, the American Revolution, I came across what I found was to be a highly concealed segment of American history and indeed British colonial history in relation to the servitude that whites experienced. And at the same time, I was also concerned, quite frankly, with what I regard as the psychological warfare aspect of this notion that whites were strictly the victimizers and never the victims. And I thought that that was quite imbalanced because my own experience among white working class people in America and poor whites, I didn't find that they actually benefited very much from their white skin, because my own thesis is that the white skin privilege pertains to the wealthy and to the upper class. And moreover, in the notion of white skin privilege, you know, we forget that, for example, Frederick Law Olmsted, which I mentioned in my book, the architect of Central Park in New York, mm-hmm. when he was in the South, he wrote the book The Cotton Kingdom as an antebellum narrative. And he talked about watching Irish longshoremen who were handling bales of cotton, and these were being dangerously thrown down into the boat where they were working. And Olmsted was concerned about their safety. And he talked to one of the white overseers of this project, and he said, oh, he said, if the paddies die, nothing's lost. We didn't pay anything for them. That's why we don't put the black slaves down there, because they're worth a great deal more. And, you know, the other thing about white skin privilege, I know I'm getting ahead of myself here, but it was a motivating factor for the book, is I consider it a hysterical term for the normal condition of every society on Earth where there's a natural advantage in being a member of the majority. I mean, in China, there's a Han Chinese skin privilege. In sub-Saharan Africa, there's a black skin privilege. And, you know, I would hope that humanity would rise above that kind of tribalism. But it seems that only whites are singled out for this. And I think, as I've shown, it really operates mainly for the white ruling class. And I consider the white skin privilege a kind of agitprop, psychological warfare. And I think it's been successful in lowering the self-esteem of whites and having them internalize this self-loathing. And that creates a lot of psychological issues, I think, for the white working class today, not the least of which is the massive drug addiction. And much of this, of course, afflicted black people as well in terms of low self-esteem. And that's why, and we'll get into this later if you choose to, why I think that this hereditary taint on black people, which the left imposes on them, which is to say that you were the main race that were enslaved, and pretty much virtually saying that the black race is a slave race. I think that in some ways my book lifts that onus off of them. But I believe in pursuing the facts and the truth wherever they go. And so if in the initial inklings that I had when I was looking, for example, at Virginia statutes, for British America in the 17th century, and where I noticed these euphemisms for these people who did not have indentures. Had that gone nowhere, had it gone into a cul-de-sac, I would have abandoned the research because I myself am revolted by histories that are driven just by a partisan agenda. And I think in our current divided atmosphere that we have here in the United States, it's very unfortunate the partisanship and yellow journalism that you see even in the New York Times, where people are so certain that they're right and that they have the truth on their side that they feel that it's okay to engage in partisan bias tactics against their enemies. And I hope that my book has maintained an objective standard, which a historian should maintain, and I'm willing to defend everything that I say there and also in other research I've done, because I'm the editor of a newsletter, Revisionist History, and as you know, we've done some additional supplemental research into these areas.
Yes, you sure have, and I appreciate you forwarding those newsletters to me. You did cover a lot of material here, and I want to go back for a minute to the word slave. Can you tell listeners about the etymology of the word slave?
Yes, the slave comes from the word Slav, which is related to, I mean, it actually comes from a medieval term in Latin, Sclavus, which was, you can find that in 9th century manuscripts, and it's identical with the racial name of Slavic people of Eastern Europe who had been repeatedly reduced to enslavement by kidnapping or conquest. So long before Africans, the people of Eastern Europe were made to bear this taint, which, as I mentioned earlier, is similar to the taint associated with the term thrall in medieval Scandinavia. So to me, it's rather outrageous that the actual etymology of the word relates to white people, and yet it's highly politically incorrect, a thought crime, to suggest that there is a relationship between whites and enslavement.
It is a very effective system of propaganda in this country. It's working really well. And there are many reasons for that that I'd like to go over just a few. However, I wanted to go back to the concept of criminalizing poor white people and the slave hunting. Can you talk about that area of research?
Yes, certainly. Well, we have to go back to Tudor England in the 16th century, and we look at the fall of the traditional Catholic rule in Great Britain. Now, Henry VIII remained a Catholic to the end of his days in terms of his association with the traditional liturgy and so forth. But obviously, when he razed the monasteries and seized their tremendous wealth and declared himself the head of the Church of England, he was gradually tossing off Rome's whole. But more importantly, apart from the papacy, what I'm referring to is the traditional common law of Great Britain, Christian-based, which had said that the common people had to share in some of the wealth of the land. I think that Pierre Proudhon, in his books related to property as theft, and talks about how there is a common ownership of the land. And so what you had was somewhat analogous to the American West before its enclosure. You could graze your livestock on the open fields. And this was in a small country like Britain, this was maintained deliberately. And so a person who had just a couple of sheep would be able to graze those sheep on the commons, as it was called. And that was slowly, we're talking about a gradual process here that's incremental, but slowly those commons were enclosed. And that created the pauperization, increasing pauperization of an English people who I feel, in my opinion, were much better off during the Middle Ages than they were in the early modern period. And so the ascendant capitalist class in Great Britain developed a kind of new morality, which just criminalized being poor. And that was in contradiction to the traditional Catholic view of the poor as being a holy state, as long as it wasn't due to shortcomings in their own lifestyle. So it was seen that the idleness which resulted from the enclosures, that was the cause of the poverty rather than its consequence. And so people were systematically evicted, and there was a steep rise in vagabondage. You had vagabonds, you had people who were going to London. These were a potentially revolutionary mass of people. So these rising numbers of itinerants fleeing their expropriated land highly impoverished, criminalized for being that. What was the reaction of the British ruling class? It was to create these local bridewells. Bridewell's a reference to the original residence of Henry VIII on the Fleet River in London. And then in 1550, it became a prison, for the able-bodied poor. And from there, and from other type of slave-catching operations, which were just out-and-out kidnapping, again, the root of the word kidnapping is actually kid-nabbing, and it's a direct reference to whites who were swept off the streets of Great Britain. Glasgow was a big center for kidnapping. People didn't allow their children to play freely in Glasgow for fear that they would be swept up, and poor people in general were swept up. And then by the early 17th century, the ruling class in London, the Lord Mayor, the Privy Council, that's where they began to commit people to Bridewell. And then that institution played a pivotal role in the strategy of populating the colonies on the other side of the Atlantic with these white slaves. Because later on, under the Waltham Black Act of 1723, you had a number of minor misdemeanors labeled felony. Well, not just labeled, but actually made a matter of law as felonies. So the breaking down a aristocrat's fish pond, stealing lace, poaching deer became felonies, and they became hanging offenses. And so instead of hanging, the idea was that you could just sweep these people into enslavement in British America. But of course, it's very important to note when we're discussing this period that each century is very different from the previous one. So I would say that the chattel slavery that I argue was the majority experience of whites in bondage in British America was largely a feature of the 17th century. By the 18th century, you had a more mixed experience of indentures and enslavement. And of course, by the 19th century, it was virtually exclusively indenture, which is what the opponents of my research claim was always the experience, entirely indentures. But indentures weren't issued for this type of, you know, mass kidnapping like this, which was largely illegal. I mean, you know, there's biblical man stealers in the Bible. I mean, that's a death penalty offense. So, this was the way they peopled the colonies, and they were without indenture. So I'll give you a quote from a law enacted in 1652. It may be lawful for two or more justices of the peace within any county, city, or town belonging to this commonwealth to issue a warrant to seize, apprehend, and detain any and every person found begging or vagrant in any town, then to be conveyed into the port of London or to any other port, and shipped into a foreign colony or plantation. And that's only the tip of the iceberg, because, again, no one is going to explicitly in law. It's the same thing when we look at so-called impressment, which is a euphemism really for kidnapping and enslavement on board ship. Blackstone and other legal commentators refused to even acknowledge that it was a kidnapping process that was illegal, even though it was obviously kidnapping, because most of us know about press gangs and people being conked on the head. And so Scottish royalty had tenant farmers to whom they owed money, kidnapped and sold to slavers under the pretense of transportation to the colonies as convict slave labor. And see, that's another issue here, Jeff, is you call them convicts. And this is what I find when I'm reading other people's histories of this era. These establishment historians refuse to acknowledge what's going on, so they accept the ruling class's demonization of these poor people as convicts. Well, what made them a convict? Well, they had criminalized all kinds of classes of misdemeanors, then they made them convicts. And of course, Australia became notorious for that, because after the American Revolution, our founding fathers refused to take any more of these white slaves from Great Britain who had been labeled as convicts and criminalized in that degree. But most of this is off the books, and a lot of my research is based on the diaries and letters of the people who actually experienced the servitude, because some of them were literate, and they referred to themselves as slaves. And many of my opponents, I think, do a grave disservice to these people by denying what they themselves call themselves.
It certainly is an eye-opener about Australia. You can see the patterns. They really didn't do anything new. They used the same system, but it's basically erasing the knowledge of documented history from reaching the public sector. And they could repeat the same thing again and again. If you would, could you go a little deeper into the slave hunting in Britain, Ireland, and Scotland, and specifically about how political dissidents and political prisoners were criminalized by penal codes?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, Jeff, because the last time this issue was broached in places like the New York Times and the Southern Poverty Law Center, they publish a couple of periodicals and related to this, was a focus almost exclusively on the Irish, because this is, for some reason, this is what's come to the fore in terms of the radar of the establishment. And I'm not limited, of course, just to Irish slaves. But what you had was, in the Irish slave thesis, which is to say that people who are partisans of the notion that the Irish were largely exceptionally victimized by the Protestant British crown, whereas I take exception to that, and I say that Protestants, the Protestant working class are just as much victimized as the Irish. But so the focus has been on Cromwell, and there are a couple of books on enslavement of the Irish, and the focus is on what Cromwell did when he came to power and during the Puritan interregnum. So the criminalizing of dissidents and political prisoners here, some people focus exclusively on Cromwell and the Irish, but actually it happened in the Stuart dynasty, which both preceded and followed Cromwell, because Charles I was overthrown by Cromwell, and then Charles II came to power after Cromwell had passed away and the Puritan interregnum largely dissolved, almost under its own weight. But in both cases, throughout the 17th century, if you were on either the losing side, not just in battles, but also of the political debate that was going on between Catholics and Protestants, because James II had been dismissed in what's called by the cryptocracy the Glorious Revolution, because he was a Catholic monarch, the brother of Charles II. So this is a little bit of background, because it's issues that don't concern a lot of people now, but they were incredibly heated and divisive at the time. And so depending on whether it was a Protestant monarch, or, of course, Charles II and Charles I were officially Anglican, but with many Catholic sympathies. For example, Charles I was married to a French Catholic queen, and Charles II was, in my view, a crypto-Catholic. And his brother, as I say, and successor, a brief successor, was an open Catholic. And so in either case, people were seized, taken as slaves to the West Indies, and enslaved in places like Barbados. And in America, where cotton was not yet a significant cash crop, it would later, of course, become the greatest material prize of North America. But at that time, it was sugar and tobacco, and they'd be enslaved on these sugar and tobacco plantations. And where are the indentures here? And you can't call them convicts, because, as you say, they were dissidents and political enemies. So again, here is a long record of enslavement of white people under very brutal conditions, side by side with enslaved blacks, and it's denied. And it's an insult to the memory of these people, and it's also something that, as a historian, I take exception to, because it's peddling falsification.
Yeah, a correct understanding of the authentic history of the enslavement of whites in America and other places in the West Indies could have profound consequences for the future of races. Can you talk about those potential effects?
Yes. I think that if we're minimizing what's happened with the white people, okay, and it strictly becomes an issue of the blacks only were, you know, bearing this thing, it's a stigma, because the untold history of the enslavement of whites, if it was better known, in my opinion, would free the black psyche from the stigma of being branded as hereditary slaves. Because then they discover that white people have been enslaved for millennia, including in early America, and that, you know, as we noted, the very word slave is derived for a name from East European Caucasians. And I think that it's equally true, Jeff, that much of the racial resentment, which continues to be instigated in America, would decrease if black people had a better understanding of the less-than-human status which white trash, hillbillies, and rednecks have experienced in America, including at the end of the rope. Let me give you a quick example. This year, the National Lynching Memorial was opened in Alabama. It's documenting what happened to black people at the end of a rope in America, but it's a generalization. It's a politicized museum because it leaves out the fact that in certain lynchings are always wrong because you're taking away the law. You're outside the law. You yourself are an outlaw. So I'm not justifying them. But the point is not brought up that blacks and whites together would lynch someone that they thought was a notorious criminal, whether that was a white person or a black person who had escaped justice. That's one point. But the second point is that all lynching of whites in America, which has a horrific history in the U.S., has been policed out of the equation. So that, for example, in the state of Montana, which was basically founded, Montana, although it was Idaho territory for a long time, because it was basically founded by gold miners. And so in Montana, you had lynching as the founding aspect, founding characteristic of the state of Montana and the gold mining towns like Bannock in the western part of the state. And for a long time, I don't know if it's still true with the Montana State Police, but they used to wear on their arm patch a number which was related to the secret society that did the lynchings. I think it was 311. And that was a reference that if you were threatened with lynching, you'd receive a piece of paper that had 311 along with some type of threat in there. And whites were hanged en masse in the 1860s. I think there were about 250 whites who were lynched. Whether they were guilty or innocent, I think that some were guilty, many were innocent. And whenever you get into these lynching things, then you have opportunistic lynchings where you get rid of someone who owed you money or is a rival for a woman, whatever the case may be. But wherever you're dealing with lynching, you're dealing with mobocracy, and that's wrong. But so the white experience of lynching in America has been policed out of this National Lynching Museum, which the New York Times and the usual media outlets have enshrined as this thing where guilty whites are supposed to go there and discover how guilty their ancestors have been. Well, you know, they're really undermining their own credibility by taking away, by omitting, by whitewashing this whole other history that's out there. And I think, Jeff, that increases racial animosity and tensions, which the white supremacists or the white nationalists can exploit. And if we're really interested in harmony between the races, first of all, we ought to concede, stop infantilizing black people and concede that they can handle the truth about the history of America. They can handle it a lot better than these extreme leftists who speak in their name can. And secondly, with this truth, I think it would be a firmer foundation for true racial harmony of the races here in this country.
While I was reading your book, I was wondering, how does this benefit the establishment by removing this record? I do agree that it does foment division between the races.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Hillary Clinton calling the Trump supporters deplorables, and now this guy Strzok, the FBI agent, who in testimony recently in front of Congress, his text messages, it was revealed that he said that the white people who went to Walmart in Southern Virginia they stink. He had the letters SMELL, the smell down there. And then in Northern Virginia, I guess he's a Virginia resident too, but maybe in one of those Tony all-white suburbs or something. And then he referred to the working-class whites of Northern Virginia who supported Trump as ignorant hillbillies. And I think that, you know, we minimize the enslavement of whites in part because we overlook the class snobbery of these aristocratic type of whites toward their own kind. And that's a fundamental tenet of my book. And of course, you know, we don't have a literal aristocracy here, but we have an aristocracy of class and money. So again, it's removed from the whole debate. It's as if wealthy whites and working class and poor whites are all united. And actually, most of us in our own personal experience can testify that that's not true. I think another brief example, although I digress here, is in terms of what surprises me, and that the whites who want open borders on our border with Mexico, they typically somehow, and maybe they don't directly do it, but it's sort of a mechanism of the U.S. government or the ruling class, is that when the immigrants come in from the America, from Central America or from Asia, they end up being dumped in white working class areas. And Atherton, California, and Walnut Creek, California, and the Tony sections of Westchester County, New York, and Virginia, and so forth, they remain all white where these liberals, you know, reside. I wonder where Hillary Clinton lives. I mean, maybe she lives in Harlem. I don't know. You know, but it seems like in most cases, there's this incredible hypocrisy. It's the poor whites and the white working class that are made to bear the burden of the policies of their white rulers. I don't see solidarity between them very much. And I'm not trying to ignite class warfare here between upper class whites and lower class. I'm trying to reflect a reality which I think has been suppressed.
You mentioned aristocrats within our society, but specifically, can you talk about the importance of the aristocratic planters, as you call them?
Well, the aristocratic planters are interesting in terms of both colonial British America as well as in the American Civil War, because in the American Civil War, and I think this is another myth, Eugene Genovese hit on some of this, and now he's become unpopular, the great historian of slavery in the South. And that is that, you know, the Lincoln, you know, right, as you recall, recently there was a toppling of Confederate monuments, and what sort of made me grin was that some of the monuments toppled were of these conscripted Confederate soldiers, you know, some buck private who was forced into the war and he fought well, and a statue was created and it's toppled into the ground. But I mean, if people really knew the history of the war between the states, a lot of the rather extreme leftists would be toppling the statues of the Union, because if you really look at the Union, Lincoln coming out of extreme poverty in Illinois and Indiana, and looking at the Free Soil Party in the 19th century, some of it with a white slave legacy in the sense that they wanted to reserve the open areas of the West for the Free Soil Party, which is something I touch on in my book, They Were White and They Were Slaves. And so Congressman David Wilmot founded this party. And the idea that the North was filled with abolitionists who were fighting to free the slaves, the North was filled with a teeming population of whites who were running into some significant obstacles in the big cities like New York that were increasingly controlled by corrupt politicians, and they wanted the West for free white labor. They had seen what had happened in the South where free white labor was degraded. And I give an example, again, from Eugene Genovese, where a black slave herself is talking about the racial hierarchy. And she said, at the top are the cream, the white plantation aristocracy. In the middle are the black slaves, she said, and down at the bottom are the white trash. And she actually saw herself as superior to them because in the face of any type of slave labor, be it black, white, or whatever, free labor is always degraded and the wages are much lower. And I think that was the experience of the poor whites in the South, many of whom, of course, did not fight, refused to fight for the Confederacy for that very reason. And we even have some documentation about the descendants of white slaves known as Hicks, from Samuel Hicks. Now, it's spelled differently, H-I-X or H-I-C-K-S. But Ray Hicks was a great storyteller. He just passed away a few years ago. He told the stories of the dirt poor whites of the South. But I ran into his nephew at a reading, and I talked to him about, since you were from the Deep South, did your family fight for the Confederacy? He said, absolutely not. We felt that we had been excluded by the aristocratic plantation sort of aristocracy, and we supported the North. And of course, Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's second vice president, was himself an indentured servant. Now, again, this is the 19th century, and as I said, the experience there was largely of actual indentures. And he ran away from enslavement in North Carolina. A wanted reward was issued for him, a wanted poster was put up, and he fled to Tennessee, where he would make good later on, to flee that bondage that he had in North Carolina. And he had been whipped and beaten, and he didn't have a whole lot of use for abolitionism because he felt that the experience of whites in bondage had been largely occluded. But my point is that many people in the North saw the South as being proactive in terms for the enlargement of the black race in America, because they derived an enormous profit from this great material prize, which was cotton. It was the equivalent of oil today. and black slave labor was necessary in order to exploit that value. And so they wanted to extend black slave labor even into California or Idaho or Oregon. And this, to me, was the fundamental motivation of many whites who were fighting in Lincoln's army, was to prevent that. And I think if you look at Congressman David Wilmot and the history of the Free Soil Party, I think that that will be borne out. So the history of America is much more complicated than we've led to believe. And that's why in my book, They Were Slaves, and I hope in the sequel, I can at least begin to encourage people such as yourself to both undertake the research and realize that the aperture through which we're seeing these things is much more shuttered than it should be.
The line was cutting out. I just want to give that title out again. They Were White and They Were Slaves, The Untold History of the Enslavement of Whites in Early America. We're speaking with Michael Hoffman, the author of this book. Michael Hoffman, you write, the British Crown utilized the American colonies as the dumping ground for the white slaves of England and Scotland, a practice that only ended with the American victory in the Revolution, after which Britain focused on Australia as its new open-air plantation for refuse, i.e. surplus white population, which was criminalized, transported, and enslaved. White slaves eventually put an end to the practice of their own physical enslavement. Can you talk about that and some of the prominent rebellions, such as the Knowles impressment riot?
Well, my reference there would be to someone like Matthew Lyon, who was an American congressman who comes into the pages of history because he opposed John Adams' sedition law and was briefly jailed, and Congress rallied behind him. But during the American Revolution, the legacy of people like him, he had written a book by the Bulls that redeemed me, and that was a reference to the fact that he had been sold for, I forget whether it was two or three stag deer, and that's how he had gone into enslavement himself. I mean, the legacy of the American Revolution, and there were many causes of it, and I do not suggest that a slave revolt was the main cause of the American Revolution, although the impressment of Americans, the enslaving Americans on board ship, is mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. And so that's what I'm referring to, that they were certainly aware that America was being used as a dumping ground for the very low status whites who existed in the teeming cities like London and who represented a revolutionary potential. And then they were swept away into enslavement without indentures in America. As far as the history of the pressed, it evolved from a slightly more benign practice. So press gang is you know, reference to the seizure of people by force and then forcing them to serve in the British Navy. And so the word press devolves from pressed, P-R-E-S-T, which was based on trickery. It was getting a man intoxicated so as to lure him as a quote-unquote volunteer for the Navy or also for the British Army in return for pressed money, which was synonymous with the king's shilling. It's from the Latin, the Latin root of the word imprestare, which is to advance. But anyway, the recruit who accepted the press money, he had to accept an advance on his future military pay, and that signaled that he was duty-bound to serve. And so these old customs evolved from the P-R-E-S-T to the P-R-E-S-S, from the pressed to the press, during the Tudor age, largely, particularly after what we talked about, the pauperization of the peasants by Henry VIII's destruction of the monasteries and the Enclosure Acts. Queen Elizabeth's enclosure laws actually were the first enclosure acts. And the use of local institutions to raise Navy seamen during the Tudor era. So you have the Privy Council acting on the monarch's behalf, distributing these so-called press warrants to their admirals and then to local magistrates. And these so-called warrants were mostly a token. They were a sop to official legality because the massive kidnapping of whites from within its own borders and from neighboring Scotland and Ireland. The street clearings, which were associated with removal of this human refuse, and that's how they were seen in the documents, dehumanized paupers, working classes of England, Scotland, and Ireland, so that the abduction for slavery on the high seas with press warrants arose commensurate with the less formal form of kidnapping for slavery in the colonies. So during the Tudor period, you had these laws for preventive policing of idle and unwanted persons, vagrancy acts, and that's how you created this sort of de facto unwanted persons being swept up by the Lords of Admiralty. And, you know, press gangs received payment for every Briton they kidnapped. And so the old pressed money evolved full circle from payment to a recruit to payment to his abductor. And free men who resisted the press gang were killed.
There were other rebellions as well. Can you talk about why it's important to understand the white slave rebellions?
Well, you asked me about the Knowles impressment riot. Would it be okay to mention that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Even though it's never taught in American schools, to my knowledge, in the way that it should be taught, in that the Knowles impressment riot was a first major act of American resistance to British colonial power. And it was a violent protest against impressment, enslavement. British officers were typically shocked by the independence and fighting spirit of the American people, American colonists. And so specifically, in November 1747, Admiral or Commodore Charles Knowles was the cause of these anti-slavery riots in America. He commissioned a press gang to kidnap a boat carrying Boston carpenters to their job site. And, you know, again, my opponents will say that almost all people who were oppressed were sailors who had a sailing background. I don't know how a kidnapping gang would determine that, but that's the notion. And it's actually not at all true. Of course, they wanted people who had sea experience, but they would train them on board. But anyway, they grabbed these carpenters in Boston Harbor. And the head of the press gang told one of the men who'd been abducted that Knowles had ordered the gang to impress all they could meet without distinction. So the American mob that subsequently attacked Knowles' officers and even the colonial governor's headquarters, William Shirley's headquarters, they numbered in the thousands at a time when the population of Boston was, what, about 16,000 at that time. So, and then the official historians described the mob as idle fellows of low circumstances and low character. You know, that's what they demonized these guys. Shirley had to flee the city. Knowles bombarded Boston from his flagship. And then Governor Shirley, outside of Boston, used diplomacy to cool Knowles down. Eventually, the mob dispersed. But what's significant here is, and again, why it's been policed out of our mainstream histories, is the uprising in Boston against Knowles' press gang is the most significant revolt against British imperial authority in the colonies prior to the Stamp Act, which would be 18 years later. So I think we should date the American Revolution from 1747, from this Knowles riot, but few historians do so, because in conformity with the politically corrupt script centered on only one experience of slavery of black people, so British sea power, founded on the backs of the hundreds of thousands of mainly white slaves who were so-called impressed into its service, where is it in our history books? Where is it in our consciousness? I mean, you can find books on impressment and on this epic, but it will always be that when you begin to approach the contours of enslavement, then they start using weasel words and euphemisms, and it's kind of sickening in a way, because they're actually pimping for the ruling class and denying this. And as I said, the percentage of white slaves in the British Navy has been estimated about 50%. Benjamin Franklin in 1770 called impressment enslavement. So, yeah, that was the Knowles thing. It's just not largely featured. And also, I would say that there were other riots and violent resistance to impressment in British colonial America rather consistently. To me, Jeff, it's more testimony to the low status of these white working class people, because if they didn't have such a low status, why would the history of their impressment be hidden and barely excavated? I think that that's some evidence of the fact that they just really don't count as human beings in some way.
Yeah, you've dug up so much material and evidence, and I can imagine how much work that would take. I like that it's really still fresh in your mind. You can recite all this information, and this book was published so long ago. Now, establishment media are increasingly haunted by growing interest in the revisionist history of the enslavement of whites. Would you please tell listeners who is responding, and are they downplaying your research? One example is that you mentioned the New York Times. They decreed, quote, "the Irish slave narrative is based on the misinterpretation of the history of indentured servitude, which is how many poor Europeans migrated to North America and the Caribbean in the early colonial period," historians said. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was an article in the St. Patrick's Day issue of 2017 by a reporter named Liam Stack, who I've tried to repeatedly contact, and I get my mail refused and stuff like that. But it's based on this history by pronouncement. They had the Times reported that, quote, "last year, 82 Irish scholars and writers signed an open letter denouncing the Irish slave myth and asking publications to stop mentioning it." The Times reports, it says, "some complied, removing or revising articles that reference the false claims." Well, you know, the title of this article in New York Times was "Debunking a Myth, the Irish Were Not Slaves." Well, the title of the article, it's false on its face. The Irish were massively enslaved by the Vikings for centuries, you know. So, I mean, right there, it's sort of a joke. And you know, it comes from this level of self-righteousness. They can't be assailed. They have to say, "I'm not a historian, and I'm a white nationalist," which I'm absolutely not. And they want to come across as that with these ad hominem arguments. And because they're not accustomed to any type of adversarial relationship with their opponents, they sort of go off on these wild goose chases, which, if you're at all conversant with the material, it's really discrediting to them. And so, you know, the Times imagines that they achieved this big feat by getting these 82 scholars, including a librarian. The head of it is this guy. He's a librarian in Ireland. And so I'll just give you this quote from the Times. It says, "Without doubt, life was bad for indentured servants. They were often treated brutally. Not all of them entered servitude willingly. Some were political prisoners. Some were children. Contemporary accounts in Ireland sometimes referred to these people as slaves. That was true in the sense that any form of coerced labor can be described as slavery from ancient Rome to modern day human trafficking," end quote. Well, the Times is flaunting the denial of white slavery in the teeth of their own evidence for its existence, because the preceding quote could have come from my book. You know, they're saying that they were political prisoners. Contemporary accounts refer to the people as slaves. So what it really is it's a debate over whether or not these horribly oppressed white people, some of them died under the lash. They died as chattel slaves in the 17th century in America, whether they deserve that term slave or not. And that's really where the battle is. Who deserves that term slave? I say anyone who was a slave deserves it, white, black, green, or indifferent. And they feel that it's very important to politicize this history. And in the meantime, I'm the one who's accused of politicizing it. And I think that the attempt to establish some kind of a difference between white slaves and black slaves, you know, they say that in colonial America and the Caribbean, the word slavery had a specific legal meaning. Europeans, by definition, were not included in it. Well, they weren't included in it because it was a crime and a disgrace for whites to enslave their fellow whites, a crime to which the British Crown wouldn't admit. So why is this so difficult to grasp? But, you know, the obtuse New York Times, they accept the official whitewash at face value. But, you know, the documents, the diaries and letters that I looked at in my book, they reveal contrary truths concerning the nature of servitude, which many whites endured. And, you know, these whites call themselves slaves. And the Times itself admits, quote, "contemporary accounts in Ireland sometimes refer to these people as slaves." So, you know, my question in the New York Times, Jeff, is who are we to believe, the 82 politically correct commissars in present-day Ireland or the accounts written in that nation 300 years ago at the time of the enslavement?
It's not only just the omission of the history, but underhanded measures deployed to suppress the information and the other efforts to, you know, spread disinformation and cover up white enslavement. And I'm wondering, how would the full exposure and understanding of this suppressed history affect the current demonization of white men?
I think it's fairly patent that if white people understood that blacks experienced a terrible Holocaust in this country, and I am not denying that for a minute, and I think it was the Southern Poverty Law Center that claimed the whole reason why I wrote my book was in order to deny reparations to American blacks. At the end of the Civil War, they were supposed to get 40 acres and a mule, and that was stolen from them, okay? That was largely denied and occluded. And whatever we can calculate the value of that over the years for now, it should be paid to them. I don't have an issue with that, okay? Holocaust reparations are being paid to Judaic people. There was a Holocaust in America against black people. But in my view, there was also a Holocaust against whites. And that's the documentary record speaking. If I'm wrong, let someone, not with name calling or fascist baiting, but from the documentary record, debate me. I'm willing to debate. And let's see who's right and who's wrong. And I do believe that there is a hidden agenda here in terms of the kind of psychological warfare against white people in order that they will yield their nation to a kind of left-wing Stalinist agenda that we're seeing here in this country. Originally, I'm a child of the late 1960s and early 70s, and I supported the freedom movement at that time because it was for freedom of speech, it was for tolerance, and now that many of my generation are in the driver's seat, they're actually adopting a kind of Stalinist position. It's the same thing with the NRA. I could debate gun control with you, which I regard as largely the disarmament of the poor, because there is never going to be gun control in America. The wealthy, Hillary Clinton will always have guys with machine guns around her. The wealthy will always be able to hire guards. It's the poor person who is going to be denied a gun. If it was total disarmament, fine, but otherwise, where you're going to have one class of heavily armed people and then the rest of the people are disarmed. No, I'm not for that. That's a definition of a slave, not having the right to own a weapon. But at any rate, current Governor Cuomo of New York, he has demonized the NRA. And okay, so demonize the NRA, but don't use the government against it, okay? Because there, what he has done is he has said that it's a reputational issue that banks and insurance companies who are representing the NRA, it's bad for their reputation. And shortly after saying that, he helped engineer fines against an insurance company that had a special relationship with NRA people who were being insured. So whether you're for or against the NRA, it's these Stalinist type of tactics that we see growing in America. And if white people are told, listen, you better just shut up and cooperate, otherwise you're a deplorable, you're an ignorant hillbilly. No, that's not the American way. We should have freedom of speech. We should have tolerance for issues of conscience. There are many facets to the gun control debate, gay marriage debate, or you know what have you. And these things need to be parsed in such a way that it's the fundamental issue is freedom. And so for me, I have seen, I have friends who own an organic farm out in the West, and they get apprentices coming in from the University of California, Berkeley, and people like that. And one guy on the farm, this was just related to me, is just consumed with guilt for being white as a result of his education at Berkeley. Now, maybe even after he read my book, even after he understood about the suppressed history of white enslavement, he would still feel that way. Well, okay, you know, that those are his own issues. He's entitled to those feelings. But I think those feelings are incubated in an environment where all of this other information is removed, and organizations like the New York Times and the Southern Poverty Law Center, they won't allow a debate. It has to be that this is evil, it's beyond the pale, and they actually endorse the idea that these so-called Irish historians were saying that articles about the enslavement of the Irish have to be removed, they have to be suppressed. That supposedly was a facet of the right wing in America in the 1950s, and we're now seeing it in the left wing in 2018. I guess what Samuel Beckett said was true when he said, this dust will not settle in its time, and when it does, some great roaring machine will come and whirl it all sky high again.
Michael Hoffman, as you say, learning about white enslavement reveals the shared experiences of the descendants of both working class whites and working class blacks. And for some, the establishment agenda comes into a clearer focus of fomenting more division among the races. And that's one of the profound insights from this book and your work. Listeners want to learn more about you and your work. What can they do?
Revisionisthistory.org, also on Twitter at Hoffman Michael A., or they can write me at Independent History and Research, Box 849, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816.
Michael Hoffman, thank you so much for being on Another News.
Thank you, Jeff.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Join me again Monday, 11 p.m. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.